So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the really great rabbis of the last half of the 20th century, was born July 20th, 1910, Chaf Gimel Tammuz, 5670, and he passed away February 20th in 1995. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was the very first child to be born in the Sha'arei Chesed neighborhood of Yerushalayim, which was only constructed around 1905. And it was one of the first neighborhoods outside of the Old City. Not the first, but certainly one of the first 10 outside of the Old City. His father was a very esteemed rabbi who came from a very long line of esteemed rabbis. And his father was a member of a very, very great rabbinical family. I'm going to speak about that in 1 second. And his mother was also the daughter of one of the more famous Jews in Yerushalayim, whose family came together with the Vilna Gaon, at least Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon never got to Israel. And his name is Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Porush. Now, you may have heard of the Porush name. It's still very important in politics in Israel. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Porush, obviously Rabbi Shlomo Zalman was named after him, was also a very, very esteemed rabbi. Now, when I say that Rabbi Auerbach's father came from a long line of rabbis, you may have heard of the Imre Bina, who was a very famous rabbi, who was Rabbi Meir Auerbach. And Rabbi Meir Auerbach was one of the leading rabbis of the Yishuv HaYashan. Without getting involved, we should really do a whole series on the history of Israel, because many of these things have been lost in the cobwebs of time, even though it's pretty recent history. And one of the great architects of the Yishuv HaYashan was Rabbi Meir Auerbach. As a matter of fact, he is the author of the ban on music. You may have heard that in the Old City, there's a ban on music. And if you have a wedding or whatever, they only play a drum. And that really comes from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman's grandfather, the Imre Bina. And the reason for it, it's rather obscure, but the reason for it, I saw this in Salmas Chaim, which is the Tshuva Sefer of Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was the rabbi of the Yishuv HaYashan in the first quarter of the 20th century, was that there was a very great plague that broke out in 1858 in the Old City of Yerushalayim. There wasn't anything else but the Old City of Yerushalayim at that point. And many people died. And they were dying. And one of the mekubalim in the city had a dream, and in the dream he was told by somebody, again, if you have these kind of dreams, you'll know who that kind of a person is, he was informed that the plague is because of the dishonor that the people who live in the old city show for the Churban. They're not properly mourning the Churban, even though they live in the shadow of the Churban. And when Rabbi Meir Auerbach found out about this dream, he said, okay, so what we have to do is we have to ban music, because we play a lot of music, and men and women can come together, and there's a lot of music, and it's not showing the proper honor for the thing. And he made the ban, and they agreed with the ban, and the day that the ban took place, the plague stopped, nobody died. So from that time on, this edict of not playing music in Yerushalayim began. So at least it tells you just a little bit, believe, don't believe, it's all of no consequence. These are just the historical events that took place, so that the Auerbach family was very much rooted as leaders, rabbinic leaders, in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman's father was a prodigious Talmud Chacham, and at the tender age of 20, he opened up a yeshiva, which exists until this very day, and it's called Yeshiva Shar HaShamayim, which was a unique yeshiva, because it was a yeshiva that kept the rigorous, basically the Beit Midrash Shoshel Hagra schedule of 3 siddurim a day, and that's how every yeshiva was. There were 3 siddurim, and then if you wanted to learn afterwards, you can learn afterwards. But in this yeshiva, they learned the regular 3 siddurim of regular learning, but at night, they were up most of the night, and they would learn Kabbalah. So that became, to this day, is known as a Kabbalah yeshiva, because they probably dropped the first 3 siddurim of learning. And the yeshiva is in the Old City. It's it's known by its very beautiful doors. It has very, very beautiful bronze work doors that you find in the Old City of Yerushalayim. And it was started by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman's father. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman didn't go to that yeshiva, clearly. As a young boy, he went to the Eitz Chaim yeshiva. Now, unfortunately, you can no longer see the Eitz Chaim yeshiva because they sold it 5 years ago. And like most of Rehov Yafo, it is all being redone in order to modernize it, in order to maximize a certain degree of revenue for the city. But there used to be this magnificent building and a very large shetach, which is why it was sold, because it's exceedingly valuable. And there was the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, which where many of the great rabbis, who turned out to be rabbis, they went there for, quote-unquote, for cheder, for their elementary school, and that is where he went. Now, at the age 5, now you're going to say, oh, that's true about all of them. Yeah, it is true about all of them. All of the people who we're going to give biographies and who have biographies, they don't have biography because they're plain people. Like, nobody's going to write a biography about me, and most of you are not going to get a biography that people are going to read. Sorry. It's because we're just plain good people, we're decent people, but we're not great. Great people get a biography because they're great. And in order to be great, certainly in the world of Torah, you've got to be smart. You have to have natural talents that you're endowed with, or else you're just never going to emerge above everybody else, because everybody's smart. But you have to be really of genius quality. And that's why you read these and think, oh, by the age of 5, he did this. Because it's all true. Now, Rav Shlomo Zalman, by the age of 5, his father started teaching him Mishnah. And he started teaching him Baba Kama. And the very next day that his father was working with him, he told his father, I learned it all by heart. And his father tested him, and he actually knew all of Baba Kama by heart. He said, okay, what does it mean? Not only did he tell him what it meant, but he said to him, and by the way, I think that our next door neighbor's chickens owes us money. The next door neighbor owes us money because the Mishnah there says that if you allow your animals to go into somebody's yard and to do damage, so then the person's chayav. So the chickens go into the Rishus HaNizek and they have to pay. So he realized at that point, he said, good. He realized at the age of 5, at the age of 5, that he had not only the talent of being a Talmud Chacham, but to be a posek. Because he already paskened the halacha that the next door neighbors owe them money for nezek. So he quickly mastered the Talmud. By the age of 11, this is found in all the biographies of him, by the age of 11 he knew all of Maseches Kedushin with Rashi and Tosfos by heart, and he began to learn Shas in the same way. He was known for his great concentration, the ability to concentrate while he was learning, and he was also known for his tremendous assiduousness and hasmada, his diligence when it came to learning. So much so, there's a famous story they tell, which was when the first automobile went down Rehov Yafo. Can I have a picture of Rehov Yafo? But now there are no more automobiles because there's a train. But there used to be cars going down Rehov Yafo in both directions. When the very first automobile came to Rehov Yafo, because otherwise it was just horse and carriage, all of the boys from Eitz Chaim, again, if you can see the yeshiva, I'm looking at the yeshiva, even though it's not there anymore. It's a very large yard that the children would play in, but you can literally see Rehov Yafo, full Rehov Yafo. There wasn't a fence at that time. And they saw this car. So all of the boys who were learning, they went to the window, look at this, Mechonit, whatever they called it, Otto, whatever they called it in Hebrew. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, even as a young boy, did not move. He was in the middle of concentrating his learning. He never saw the car. Everybody else saw the car, and even as a young boy, he was known for his power of concentration. Now, Rav Shlomo Zalman progressed very quickly in the yeshiva. Now, the person who was the head of the yeshiva was a very, very great rabbi in his own right, Rabbi Issa Zalman Meltzer. He was the father-in-law of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, also a great rabbi who made his fame here in America, but he was considered to be the elder Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim. And he also had a very packed schedule of learning, but the way that he would do it is he would have multiple chavrusos. And when he heard of this Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, that young boy who was so good, because he learned a lot, he tested him, and he said, yeah, you're good. And he asked him to be his chavrusa, so he became chavrusa with the person who was the greatest scholar of that time. We'll get back to that in a second. Let's talk a little bit about his home life. So he had two brothers and a sister. His sister, by the way, would end up marrying Rabbi Shalom Shvadron, a person worthy of his own biography. He was the Maggid of Yerushalayim after Ben Zion Yadler, and he was very, very famous. And he has other two, he had two other brothers. One of them died, unfortunately, and the other one was a Rosh Yeshiva. He took over when his father died. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Shar HaShamayim. These children grew up in abject poverty, total poverty, and there was basically as many as most of Yerushalayim. There's no food to eat, and these three children would have a treat once a week, where the mother would be able to get an egg, and she would scramble the egg. She'd mix in flour to extend it, an egg extender, and all three children, all three boys, would eat the egg. And the girl would have to get her own egg, because for a shidduch she had to have a rosy complexion. So the girls would get a whole egg, but the boys would have to split the eggs, three ways, one egg. And the truth is, if you ever met Rav Shlomo Zalman, I met him a few times, Rav Shlomo Zalman was very, very thin, very slight human being, but very, very thin, and he ate very little. He said that in the first 30 years of his life, he never had the sensation of his stomach being full. He never lost the sensation of hunger. For the first 30 years of his life, he was always hungry. That's an incredible thing to say, 30 years. We all of us have to lose weight. And he never felt that sensation. And now, he said, however, that he found a cure for nagging hunger. When he would concentrate in learning, he forgot all about his hunger. So he said that whenever he was hungry, he would learn. And in that way, he'd be able to learn at night and during the day, because he was always hungry. He had a very strict schedule. He was known for that strict schedule all of his life. Basically, he did not waste time. He did not waste time. And this is something that you hear about many of these kinds of rabbis. Like when you hear about, if you ever will read a book about, let's say, the last great rabbi to die, Rabbi Yoshev, when he died, you'll read that he never wasted moments. And it's true. I mean, I actually saw Rabbi Yoshev many, many times for many, many hours. Literally never wasted seconds. And he, you know, the Vilna Gaon, who's like the father of all of these people, that Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, his primary student, writes in his Kakdama to Sifrei Tzniusa, the commentary that the Gro wrote to Sifrei Tzniusa, that after the Vilna Gaon died, they found a little ledger that he had of all of the time in his life, from the time he was bar mitzvah, that he was mevatel Torah, that he had bittul Torah. And it came out to 33 minutes. He lived to the age of 70. So from 13 to 70, those were the minutes that he wasted. So they did that in terms of just every football game, we waste that. Okay. I shouldn't say that in this season of football games, but something to think about. Now, at the age of 18, he wrote a full commentary on Shev Shmatzah. Shev Shmatzah is a very scholarly work by the Ktzos, and that everybody had to know. There were six Shmatzos. And everybody, I mean, as a kid, one of the things that you did on Sunday, you went to Shev Shmaitzer class after school. You went to Shev Shmaitzer class. I went to Rabbi Prager, Rabbi Shlomo Prager, the head of the Kollel on the west side, Rabbi Prager, that's his father. So we went to Shev Shmaitzer class. Everybody did that. It was a very important work that you needed to know. Anybody here live Shev Shmaitzer? Oh, okay. So at the age of 18, he wrote a comprehensive commentary on it, which was a wonder. He showed it to his father. And his father said, "This is fantastic. I want you to hide it. I don't want anybody to see this. I don't want you to publish it. It's going to be a secret between me and you." Later on, he asked his father why. He didn't question his father. Another novel idea, never to question your father. And he complied. But he asked his father afterwards, why, years later, why did he say that? So he said, because it was so good, you would get popular acclaim, especially because you're so young, and you might become arrogant. And one of the ways to ensure never to become a Torah scholar is to become arrogant. And therefore, I did it to save you from yourself. That book was published posthumously. It was published about 10 years ago. It's amazing. Anybody who reads the book, it's amazing that an 18-year-old boy could have written that commentary. So that he was somebody who was very, very special, even at a very, very young age. Now, the very next thing that he did was, after he continued his studies, he sought out rabbis who were great poskim, and he tried to become close with them, and indeed he did. He became very close with two of the leading poskim of that generation. One of them is not going to be that famous a person to us. His name is Rabbi Zelig Reuven Benges, who was considered to be the chief posek of Yerushalayim at that time. And also another great rabbi, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank. That's a name that you've heard of. And he became very close with them. And they guided him and said, you should concentrate on halacha because you have a natural ability. You know, just in parentheses, there's a very famous statement of the Netziv. But the Netziv was a very great rabbi. He was the Rosh Shiva Valosh. And he said that he was not a posek. He was not a posek. That wasn't his. He said, because you have to be born a posek. A poor posek is born. There's a very special quality to be a posek, and you have to be born with that quality. And it says, if I didn't have it, but it was clear, and Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank said that about Rabbi Auerbach, that he was born with that quality. He was born with the quality to be a posek. So he studied with them as well as with the other teachers, and at the age of 20, which was pretty late in that society, he got married to Chaya Rivka Ruchmelin, and as was the custom at that time, because nobody had any money, he moved in with his in-laws. And his kests, just to show you, you know, now they go $20,000 a year, $50,000, God knows what people get for, you know, marry a Talmid Chacham. So his kest was one egg a week. That was very, very special. The first time that he got the egg, the little children in the house came to him, and as he was eating the egg, they were all going, you know, basically, can we have some? Can we have some? So he decided that it wouldn't be fair for him to ever have the egg, so he told his father-in-law, if the children don't get an egg a week, I don't get an egg a week. So then his father-in-law says, well, what am I going to give you? What am I going to give you? He says, a warm blanket will be sufficient. That's what, that'll be my kest, a warm blanket, and he got a warm blanket. Yeah?
What's a kest?
I don't think there's an English definition of a kest. It's spelled K-E-S-T, and it's not an English word. It means that when you would be married, because you were considered to be a person who had to continue learning their studies, because you had promise, not everybody got a kest, but if you were a Talmid Chacham who had promise, so then the father-in-law would promise you something of great value. So Daniel, let's say you today wanted to get married. You're married, thank God, you have a family. But let's say you would want to get married. So you would say, I am a very big Talmid Chacham, but I want to continue my studies. So you would go to a father-in-law, and he would say, through the shatran, I think $50,000 a year would be sufficient, because you're not a pig. If you would get it, that would be a kest. And many, many people across the world in the yeshiva world, they get this kest. It's not a dowry because the girl gets a dowry, but it's called a kest. And that was very, very prevalent. But again, it was not a lot of money. It was a small thing. It was some kind of a token, as you can see, in this kind of a poor thing. Anyway, moving on. After he married, he decided that he wanted to go to the kollel of Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank. Now, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank would soon be the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. And as a matter of fact, his kollel is a place, there's now a big shul called Har Tzvi, but the kollel used to be on top. Anybody ever Har Tzvi? It's on Rehov Tzfanya. Okay, it's in the other Jerusalem that our people don't go to. But that's the other Jerusalem. And he went to learn in this kollel. It was called Kollel Kerem Tzion. And what was unusual about the kollel is the concentration was on mitzvos hatulios ba'aretz. That was what they studied. And he specialized in that. And while he was in the yeshiva, the question of using electrical items, we're talking now in the 30s. In the 1930s, and Israel still was a very primitive society, and they first got electric lights. They first understood about wiring electric lights. And the question was, can you use these on Shabbos or not? Is it called Havara? Is it called Eish? Nobody knew. Nobody at all knew, because it was something that was absolutely brand new. The whole idea of using incandescent bulbs was something brand new. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman was basically commissioned. They said to him, your project, figure it out. And he went upon a very extensive search for the law, but in doing so, he had to learn physics, he had to learn math, he had to learn electronics, he had to learn everything he possibly could in order to understand what made this work. And he did that. And he put out a sefer on it in 1935, which was known as Ma'ore Ho'esh, obviously a play on Ma'ore Ho'esh. It was a play on it, and immediately it got popular acclaim. The book, before he published the book, he sent it to the Chazon Ish, a famous rabbi, and he also sent it to Rabbi Chaim Olzer Grozovsky, who was the chief rabbi of Eastern Europe. When Rabbi Chaim Olzer Grozovsky saw the sefer, he said, this is a fantastic sefer. And he said, Or Chadosh L'Tzion to Al Tzion to Yer. He said, this is a brand new light. And he says, Ani lo zoz mi sefer hazeh. He wrote that somebody asked him a question about lights. So he says, look at that sefer Ma'ore Esh. I, Rabbi Chaim Olzer, Ani lo zoz mi sefer hazeh. I follow everything that you find in that book. Interestingly enough, the Chazon Ish took serious issue with one of his Piskei Halacha, because the Chazon Ish maintained that opening a light switch is an Issa d'Oraisa of Bona. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman wrote almost what would be considered to be a sefer in rebuttal of the Chazon Ish. Here you have a 25-year-old fellow arguing with the Chazon Ish, which was something. And if you read it, as a matter of fact, it's in this book. Half of this book is devoted to rebuttal, Milcha Shlomo, in rebuttal to the Chazon Ish. And in fact, people who read his rebuttal find his arguments against the Chazon Ish exceedingly compelling, very, very compelling. So that even at that young age, he was able to do it. It was interesting. You have a second for this? There's an interesting thing about the Chazon Ish. You say, oh yeah, so this Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, at least he studied physics and all the things that he needed to do. And Chazon Ish, some dude in Bnei Brak, what does he know about electricity? In fact, we have a calendar, and the calendar has corrections. You need to make corrections because of the chelek. The chelek is a very small, is an infinitesimal, it's a third of a second. And from time to time, the calendar needs to have corrections. So it's corrected, but for a few hundred years. Now, they came to the Chazon Ish, and they said to him, our calendar is only corrected until 1990. And this goes back into the 40s. So what he did was, he took 6 months off, and he went to Hebrew University. And in 6 months, he took all of the courses that they had in math. He took all of the courses they had in physics and in astronomy in 6 months. And he mastered all of them. These guys are geniuses. And he mastered all of them. As a matter of fact, there was an editorial against him in Haaretz, or the precursor of Haaretz. So these rabbis talk about Bittul Torah. And 6 months is not called Bittul Torah? That he went to a university? You can't win. Sometimes you can't win if people don't like you. Whatever. And they didn't say, could you imagine an older person in 6 months mastering things that take people years? They didn't say that. Anyway, so the Chazon Ish was very well grounded in these things to argue. But again, this was really an argument between two I would consider them two titans. Okay. Now, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, while he was in the Kollel that was studying Mitzvah Satzulos, he did not neglect his studies, but he had, I don't know exactly what this means, but he said it. I actually heard him say this, because he said it to my father when I was sitting there. He said, my two favorite mesechtos, it's hard to understand if someone would say my favorite mesechtos. He said, my two favorite mesechtos are Beitza and Kedushin, and I've learned both of them over 500 times. And that was many years before he passed away. He says, from Beitza and Kedushin. That's what he said. And he really continued his studies there. And in 1944, he decided to leave that kollel But before he left, he published a major work, a comprehensive work on Shemitah, which is known as Ma'adani Eretz. And then he published two similar works, one on Trumos, one on, that one was on Shemitah. Interestingly enough, in his book on Shemitah, he agrees with a person who he admired, and he wrote that he admired him, and he paid for it. He admired Rav Kook very, very much. He said, Rav Kook, what a Talmud Chacham he was. And he says, and I agree with him on the Heta Mechira in that book, and he still published it. I agree with him on the Heta Mechira. And then he wrote two more books, different volumes of Ma'adani Eretz, meaning, you know, the laws of Israel, the things that are Ma'adanim that he finds in Israel on Trumos and Masros. And then he also had what he called, this I heard from Shmuel Orbach, I had three more Chalukim of Ma'adani Eretz in my brain, but what happened afterwards did not allow me to actually write them. And that was that after he published his book, Ma'adani Eretz, on Shemitah, he got an offer to become the Rosh Yeshiva of a Yeshiva Gedola, which was a relatively new one in Bayit Vagan called Kol Torah. So the head of the Yeshiva, Rabbi Yonah Mansbach, that's because Rabbi Schlesinger had died, who was the first Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah, and this Rabbi Mansbach made the offer to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, said, but if you have to come for a Prabha is a Shiula Dugma. You have to give a Shiula Dugma in the yeshiva. And he gave it to the major shiur. And so in the middle of the shiur, this Rabbi Mansbach asked him a question. It was a very good question. And he said, so Rabbi Shlomo Zalman thinks about it for a minute. And he says, Tatzodek, Ta'iti. And then he continued with the rest of the shiur. When he came home that afternoon, his wife said, how'd it go? He said, it didn't go well at all. I was giving the shiur, and he asked me a question. And the truth is, I had three good answers. But his answers were not as good as his question. And therefore, I just said nothing. I said, I made a mistake. So I don't think I have the job. They contacted him. They didn't call. They contacted him 2 days later, and they said, okay, when can you start? So he said, but you asked me a question. I said, I made a mistake. He said, so you're Ish Emes. Who should be the Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah? If not an Ish Emes, a person who's honest. And that is how he got the job. By saying Ta'iti, he got the job. And he became the Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah, which was really, he became a legend in Kol Torah. And many, many people came to the yeshiva because he was there. Let's just say that he gave a very good shiur. If you look, now they published posthumously, they published a number of his sfarim on his shiurim, basically, on Gemara. Now, if you look at those sfarim, you will notice that he had a very unusual method in learning. It was not the usual method in learning, but it was, and it's not Rabbi Lichtenstein either I'm going to use the word that Rabbi Lichtenstein used, which was conceptualizing the sugya. That's what he did. He would conceptualize the sugya, and then he would, in other words, he would look at the whole sugya as a whole, and then he would deconstruct the sugya, rather than most of the style is to build the sugya. He would deconstruct. I mean, take any one of his forum, and you'll see that's exactly what he does. He deconstructs the sugya into its component parts, and then he puts it back together. And when he put it back together, it was a lot larger than when he deconstructed it. That was his style, which was an unusual style. It was a very analytic style, very conceptualizing the formulation of things, and it became very, very popular, and he had many, many people who went to his shir, and it was a very clear. He had a lot of clarity in his explanation. Again, just look at his sefer, and you'll see that it's on the blot. Very, very clear in terms of how he saw the Gemara. Nobody learned the Gemara that way. I find it very hard to learn it because it's so different than everybody else. So you're arguing with the Rashba or you're agreeing with the Rashba? You agree with the Rambam or you're arguing with the Rambam? It's sometimes hard to know. Because he ends up with a different version of the Rambam than the Rambam had. And he said, no, that's what the Rambam meant, because otherwise it doesn't fit. It's very unusual. But people enjoyed it. Now, in truth, there's a personality that we are very familiar with, where there are very strong parallels between that personality and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And that's Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Because one can actually say that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach was the Israeli version of the American Rav Moshe Feinstein. Let me tell you what I mean. Both of them, which is unusual, both of them were formerly, their job description on their CV, it said Rosh Yeshiva, of a real yeshiva. And they would give shiurim a number of times a week. And then they would give a shiur klali once a week. So that the shiurim that they gave were masterful shiurim, which made them, quote unquote, Rosh Yeshiva, which was a separate job. It was a separate job description to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Not everybody could be a Rosh Yeshiva to give those kind of shiurim. And both of them did that. And they were also preeminent, but not official poskim. They were not a moreit tzedek of any group, of any kahila, of any community. So that they were people who were poskim, but they were untitled poskim. As a matter of fact, Ramosha, if you look at the Hakdama to Igros Moshe, Ramosha said, how did I get to be a posek? I was just sitting there on the Lower East Side and giving shiurim, and a person would come in and say, I have a dilemma in halacha, what should I do? And I answered it. He liked my answer. He told somebody who had another dilemma, why don't you go to that Feinstein guy, because he answered nicely. And then after a while, everybody just came to me, and they liked my answers. Everybody came to me. And the same thing is exactly true with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He wasn't an official posek, but people would ask him questions. And he would answer the questions, and people liked his answers, so they sent their friends. And eventually, he became a posek. Also, both of them were fused, they fused together humility and authority, which is very, very difficult to do. To have a tremendous amount of authority, tremendous amount of power, that you know that what you say will be listened to by many, many people, and at the very same time, never to become arrogant, lehefech, not arrogant, but to never lose extreme humility. And if you look at their piskei halacha and controversial items, now, just as Rav Moshe wrote a tremendous amount of piskei halacha on social issues and on medical technological issues, so too did Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach write on those elements, especially medical issues. And if you look at the Psak Halacha, and they say it in the Tshuva, they say that part of the consideration we have is to promote a certain sense of harmony within the community, and at the very same time, to remove ourselves from confrontation, from discord. So that they both had this idea of the diminution of confrontation, and to promote harmony, and they use that as a modus vivendi in their analysis of situations. They both dealt with cutting-edge, modern questions on technology and on medicine, and they always came to the same conclusion. It's an interesting thing. They at least almost always came to the same conclusion. I mean, Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, each approached halacha with a sensitivity to human concerns, which sometimes will lead you away. I'm saying this sweetly. Sometimes when you're so over-concerned for how people will feel about what you say, meaning no person wants to hear no, so some poskim, what they'll do is they'll not be as loyal to the halacha as they are to the sensitivities of other people. And in fact, that's not why they're asking you a question. If they wanted compassion, they would go to their friend. They're coming to you for halacha. And yet Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman, they were able to have this high fidelity to the halacha and at the very same time find a tremendous amount of compassion in their piskei halacha. And another similarity, which I find to be incredible, is that they were both very firmly rooted in the Haredi community. They were Haredim. There's no two ways about it. Both of them lived the Haredi lifestyle, had a Haredi philosophy, but they maintained a genuine, a real rapport with the full range of the Torah community. And everybody who came from, no matter who you were comfortable going to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I'm going to say some other things. Now, the analogies aside, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach certainly can be appreciated for his own unique merits. Now, first of all, he had an encyclopedic knowledge, and it was on his fingertips. Now, I was in his house twice, both times with my father. Now, the way that we got an appointment. Usually, you didn't get an appointment. I'll talk about how you got to see him. Anybody can get to see him, but we actually had an appointment, and we were in the house without anybody else there. Now, if you ever saw him again, it was very, very thin. but he had this gigantic smile, very thin face. There was almost like nothing there, but he had these big white teeth and a big gigantic smile, and it was like the smile was always on his face, like a happy kind of a man. Like if you look around this room, nobody's got a smile on their face. We're not so happy, but he was always happy, always happy. So my father had some questions. One of them was a status question. I remember that was a question of Yichus. It was a complicated question, and he was there. So Rav Shlomo Zalman, his first reaction was to worry about the family. Oy, oy, oy. They must be in so much pain knowing that they have this issue. That's a problem. Oy, they just found out about it. Oh. And he was almost on the verge of tears when he heard the story. So he identified with the problem. And then to me, which is amazing, and if you were in the house, you know what I'm saying. So he had this room, like most Israelis, live in a small apartment in Shaarei Chesed. And he had a room, but all around the room were bookcases. All around the room were bookcases. It was funny, the ones that he sat this way and had bookcases behind him. Now the ones that were behind him had no covers on them. There were no covers, they were basically falling apart. And he was poor, he couldn't replace them. So he had to get a sefer. He did not turn around. He says, Amunut. And he went like a minute. He turned around, grabs a sefer. He didn't even look. It was the sefer that he was looking for, without a cover. He was looking, and he got it. And he opened it up, and one thing to the right. Oh, shteita. To me, that was an amazing kind of a thing, that he was able to grab books without even looking. He knew exactly where the books were. It's an incredible thing. And no books behind him had any covers on them. They were all like trashed. And he had this knowledge, and his temperament was very judicious. He thought a lot before he answered a question, and he was also mindful. I remember he asked my father, he says, Haskefrek Ramoshe? Did you ask for Moshe? We're American, did you ask for Moshe? So my father said, I did. And he wasn't ready to answer the question. Which was a fact. He wasn't ready to answer the question. So he says, "For Moshe kenish the enfer, Avada kenish the enfer." If Moshe didn't know, I'll tell you this. And he answered the question in a very beautiful way. He answered the question, and he was very often very bold and very innovative in the answers that he gave. And he sometimes rankled the halakha community in Israel by giving a very lenient answer to something that they held to be self-evident that you can't do it. Like, for example, his refrigerator psak halacha, that you can open up a refrigerator on Shabbos. So they say, oh, but the motor's going to go while you leave too much air. He says, no, it's an ena miskave, and it's a psikration dudol nichale, this and that. And he said that you can do it. And they said, take it back. And he wouldn't take it back. He says, I think that's the law. Don't follow it. I think that's the law. Now, when I said he was accessible, every day at 2 o'clock, without fail, he davened in the Grosh Shul. Again, if you know Shaarei Chesed, he davened in the Grosh Shul. His house was a straight walk from the Grosh Shul. So people would walk him back from the shul, this and that. He would go up his steps, and there was a line of 50, 100 people at 2 o'clock waiting to ask him questions. Everybody came in. He asked everybody if they would like something to drink. Was it hot outside? And if you said yes, you shouldn't say yes. If you said yes, he would go to his little kitchen and he'd bring you a glass of water from the tap. They didn't have bottles of water. And that's what he would do, because Hachnas Hazarchan. And he would answer people's questions, and he would do it in a very, very beautiful way. Always would smile, and he would always make the questioner have a sense that it was a good question. Even though very often the question was not a good question. It was the kind of question that you can ask your wife, she'll know the answer. But he was very, 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 very wonderful that way. He was also very much in touch with the world, even though he was apolitical. He was never got involved in politics. It's interesting that his son, Rabbi Shmuel Auerbach, also never was involved in politics. And then in the past 3 years, he's super involved in politics, in bad politics. And it's against the family custom. It's very, very hard to understand how he did that, but he never would do that. He had a very healthy respect, as I mentioned before, for not only Rav Kook, but for any of the people who he considered to be builders of the land. He had a very close relationship with Shimon Peres. because he considered him to be one of the builders of Eretz Yisrael. And Peres would often go to his house. Shimon Peres, also a very interesting person, who had many, many different loyalties, and many of them total loyalties in his own way. Now, one of the, again, interesting things about, and this I heard from Rabbi Aviner. Rabbi Aviner used to go to, Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, he used to go, is he too right wing for here? Anybody ever hear of him? Okay. He's a great rabbi. So Rabbi Shlomo Aviner said that he had a kippah srugah, so he was afraid to go the first time. He was afraid to go to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. First of all, it's in a Haredi neighborhood, and he wore a kippah srugah. So he was thinking, maybe he should put on a samet a kapel. He should put on a satin kind of a thing. So he said, I'm going to do that, but he forgot to do it, and he went. So he says he was shocked. There was a line outside the door, and many people had kippot srugot. Many of his colleagues, they were there. So he said, you come here? He had people who were from the Dati Lu'umi community who were very comfortable being with him, and he was comfortable being with them. And that's something which I think is quite unusual. When you went to Rabbi Yoshev, you didn't find people with kippot srugot, ever. They weren't comfortable speaking to him. But Shlomo Zalman Orbach was somebody who was really so involved in the world. People were very, very, and they found that he had a very open mind and he had a very ready ear. And a number of the Piske Halacha, when they had problems with Arab, can I say these words? I'll say it. When Arabs attacked Jews in their communities, in their shkunot, and in the areas outside of Israel, he was very, very lenient in Hilchos Shabbos for security, very lenient. Which again rankled many people, but he felt everything is pikuach nefesh. If pikuach nefesh, he used to say this: "Kachol shav yu rabbanim." If it's pikuach nefesh, you could be machal Shabbos. There's a very famous story about him. It's actually in the Sefer. And the question came to him in the following way: there was a Rosh Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, and he had a old friend from Europe, and that friend from Europe, after the Holocaust, decided he doesn't believe in anything, but he believes in friendship. And he would always go to this Rosh Yeshiva. He lived in America, and he would come to this Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, who was an old friend, and they were in the camps together, and he would always leave a large check for the yeshiva. And then it occurred to this Rosh Yeshiva that when this old friend came, he would offer him food and drink. But it occurred to the Rosh Yeshiva that he didn't make a bracha before he ate. Now the halacha is that it's lifnei iver. If I know that you're not going to make a bracha before you eat and drink, I'm not allowed to give you food, because I'm giving you food knowing that you're going to eat it without a bracha. Kol anenu ma'olam hazeh ilu gozel kneses Yisrael. The serious things about not making a bracha. I'm not allowed to give him food. So it's lifnei iver. So he didn't know what to do. So he went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and he said, "This is my dilemma." So Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, "Oh yeah, I hear your question. I hear your question. So the next time your friend comes, don't give him anything. And he's going to say to you, you know, I'm thirsty. Can I have something to drink? I'm hungry. Can I have something to eat? So you're going to say, no, I used to give you the food, but now I realize I can't give you the food because you're not going to make a bracha. And if you're not going to make a bracha, it's lifnei iver lo sitei michshol, and that's why I'm not giving you the food." So what's the reaction of the person going to be, says Rabbi Shlomo Zalman? "Oh, I love God now. I love these religious people. That's fantastic. Oh, I'm so moved by his answer. He's saving me from lifnei iver lo sitei michshol." Says, no. He's going to hate you. He's going to hate what you represent, and he's going to hate God. So I maintain it's a revolutionary psak halacha, because Rabbi, look at the Tzitz Eliezer says, I think he's off the wall for saying this. But that's what Shlomo Zalman said. I believe that a greater Avera I can't use the word trumps either, supersedes a small lifnei iver. That if from the violation of lifnei iver you can save somebody from a worse thing, you're allowed to do that. You're over lifnei iver, lo sitei michshol, even so you're allowed to save that person. Which it's in the psak is in the sefer in chelak tinyon. Another argument that he has with Tzitz Eliezer. Now this is not in his sefer, but we know that he said it because it's in the Tzitz Eliezer sefer, which is something that happens all the time. I know it happens all the time to me. and I don't use the Tzitz Eliezer, I use the Shlomo Zalman Arbach. You're walking in Israel on Shabbos, and a car stops asking for directions. Now, I would never ask for directions, because whenever I did, I got bad directions. That's another matter.
You know.
Nah, even when it's not Yasha, Yasha, smaller. So they just, whatever. So, are you allowed to give directions? Now, if it's a Jew, so then you shouldn't be able to give directions because you're telling him to drive. So they went to the Tzitz Eliezer, and the Tzitz Eliezer says, you don't give directions. If there's a concept that you're having a Mishnah, I'm not going to get into it. Haliteni l'Rosha v'yomus. He's driving on Shabbos, he's a Rosha. So Haliteni l'Rosha v'yomus, just like you don't have to put up a sign, the fruit is Orla. Because you don't have to save a person from stealing, and then the Isra of Orla, you don't have to do that. You don't give him instructions. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach analyzed it differently. Just, first of all, there are many non-Jews who live in Israel, and maybe it's a non-Jew. Suffolk is a Jew and not a Jew. So you're going to say, Rove, that it's a Jew. Now, what happens if you don't give him instructions? You don't give him directions. Either he'll be driving around, or he'll be driving to the next person for instructions. As opposed to, what if you give him instructions and they're correct? And they're correct. You give him the directions, they're correct. It has to be correct. So he'll drive to the place that you've directed him to in the straightest, least Chilul Shabbos way. So you've saved the person from Chilul Shabbos. He's driving anyway. And that's what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says. It's an approach, but it's an approach. You can take the approach that Tzitz Eliezer is not wrong. There's a Mishnah that says you don't have to put up a sign that your fruit is Arla because the person's stealing if he takes your fruit. So you don't have to protect the thief from another Aveira, Haliteni L'Rosha V'Yomus. It could apply here. But if you use Rav Shlomo Zalman's Auerbach, it's a more benevolent approach to everything. And you come out with a very good halachic rationale to give the person correct directions, the fastest way to get to his location. There's another very, very famous story. You can't not tell this story, which is two parents come to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and they have a child. Again, I don't know what the right words are. They used to use a bad word called retarded. What's the right word? Okay, whatever it is, whatever that correct word is, that's the word I'm using. And they came and they said to him that it's impossible at home. The other children and us, he's just driving us crazy. We want to institutionalize him. So we want to know if we can do that. So Shlomo Zalman says to them, and what did your son say? When you mentioned this to him, I said, well, we didn't ask him. He says, you didn't ask him? But yeah, but he's the other word. See, he says, you're about to evict a child from his house, from his home, and put him in a strange environment, and you didn't ask him? I want to speak to him. I can't answer your question until I speak to him. So they come back the next day with the child. He's clearly not well. So Shlomo Zalman wanted to see what level he had. He said, what's your name? So the boy says, my name's Akiva. So he said, my name's Shlomo Zalman. What do you do? So he says, I play. So he says, I'm a rabbi. People come to me, they ask me halacha. You know what the halacha is? Yeah, what you do? I'm a rabbi. You know, what would you feel if you are going to go to a new school and you're going to be in charge of all of the religious things? You're going to be like a rabbi. You're going to be like me. And you'll make sure that all of the religious things in that new school are in order. Would you like that? He said, yeah. He says, I'm giving you smicha. I'm making you a rabbi. And you are now the rabbi of that facility. Are you going to do a good job? He said, yes. That's how he dealt with everybody. That's an incredible story to even think of that. Just an incredible, incredible human being. Let me just say a few more things. Do I have time? You never tell me how much time I have. It's terrible. Now, one of the great accomplishments that Rav Shlomo Zalman had, there's a very famous book on Hilchas Shabbos called Shmirah Shabbos Kol Chaso that was written by one of Rav Shlomo Zalman's students, Rabbi Yehoshua Neivart. very famous book. It's translated into English, Feldheim. They just did a new. It's been revised a few times. I still use the first one, which has the most leniencies in it, which is an interesting phenomenon. So I say, if it was not Chilul Shabbos in 1970, it's not Chilul Shabbos in 2017. That's my opinion. But most of the book, look at the footnotes. Most of the book is Kach Shamati Mipi Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Almost the whole book is Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Now, he could have authored the book. He didn't author the book. He wanted his student to author the book. But one of the really the great works on Hilchos Shabbos is that particular book, and almost all of it comes from him. Now, he also was very much, very, very much part of the boom in halacha and medicine. Now, while the Tzitz Eliezer, who was the chief chaplain at Shabbat Tzedek Hospital, is also very famous for medical kinds of things. But in fact, Rav Shlomo Zalman, behind the scenes, now, one of the things about Rav Shlomo Zalman is he didn't publish most of his Piskei Halacha are oral. Most of them. They're thousands and thousands. They're oral. And I think it was done purposely, because once you write it down, so then people can interpret what you wrote. But if you have a specific question with a specific answer, so then it's that specific question and specific answer. And he gave many, many different Piskei Halacha. But these are also enshrined in books, because Dr. Avram Steinberg of Bika Cholim, then Shabbat Tzedek Hospital, he was a physician there, he's still a physician there, he asked Rav Shlomo Zalman many, many different questions. And he wrote a book, and in his book, he has all of those rulings, and the name of the book is Nishmas Avram. It's in a number of volumes. Also was translated into English. Many of the volumes translated into English, based upon the Dal Chalke Shulchan Aruch, and you see psak halacha after psak halacha in medical ethics and medical situations in that book. Another very famous book that was written by Dr. Avraham S. Avraham is called the Encyclopedia of Medicine, Encyclopedia Halachtit Rufuit, and also in Asya, which is a medical journal. And you see literally thousands of, not hundreds, but thousands of Piskei Halacha in the area of medicine that come from him. Just some of his, now to us we're very modern, so everything's allowed. I'm saying this in a nice way. So to us it's not going to sound so remarkable. But in true Halacha, these are remarkable Piskei Halacha. Now, for us, contraception is a given. In fact, it's a very strong Halachic issue to use contraception. And you certainly are allowed to use contraception, shalosh mishamshos b'moch, certainly when there's physical danger. But what about psychological danger? It's not found in Chazal. Psychological danger is not found in Chazal. Now, in Israel, many women, especially religious women, that's both in the Dati Le'umi community as well as in the Haredi community, in the Hasidic community, have many children. They have more than what we would consider to be normal. They'll have 7, 8, 9 children, and they have them one after the other. Now, that's very difficult for the mother, not only physically but mentally, because you have to cope with a lot of kids. Together with your most women work in Israel, and you've got to cope with a tremendous amount, and it causes a tremendous amount of mental anguish contemplating if I'm going to sleep with my husband, I have another baby. And he was the first person to say that, as far as I'm concerned, mental distress is equal to physical danger. And therefore, again, not everybody, but if you ask a question, he said that should be a very strong consideration in giving a heter. He was the only rabbi that I know of who said without question that if a woman is raped, she should take the after morning pill the very, very next day, and it makes no difference if she was raped by a Jew or by a non-Jew. He took a very strong stand, an unusually strong stand, against single women becoming pregnant using sperm of somebody that's not their husband. Took a very strong stand. He said really strong things about it. He also took a very strong stand in terms of end-of-life issues. And he said that under no circumstances can oxygen, nutrition, hydration be removed from a live person? Even though it's now debated, because I said many of his things are done orally, but there is a written document where he signed a letter saying that he did not believe that brain death is brain death. And for us, it's not controversial, but in halachic circles, it's very controversial. And he did. Now they're saying that he said it orally. But meanwhile, we have a signed document. He took a very strong stand on that as well. He also took a strong stand with a kula, which many people to this day disagree with him, that a person who is hard of hearing or deaf can wear a hearing device and they can adjust it on Shabbos. This is his logic, that all of them are controlled by batteries. And everybody agrees that, even the Chazon Ish would agree that a battery is a Issa Drabanan. He maintained that B'mokom Choli or B'mokom Tzar Lo Gozru Bei Rabanan, and he says there can be no greater distress to a person than people speak to him and he can't hear what they're saying. And he based that Psak Halacha on that. Just to end. I'll end with a halacha and just something he left in his will. On Shabbos, now this is something that he said in Shir, and this is a story that is found by one of his Talmidim who wrote this in one of his Sfarim, it's a Sefer on Halacha, but at the end a tribute to Shlomo Zalman Orbach, his teacher, who said he owes everything. But he said, this is a story that he told in Shir, that it was Sunday morning Shir. He said, yesterday I was very upset. I had a terrible Shabbos. Somebody destroyed my Onik Shabbos. I love Shabbos. I look forward to Shabbos. They destroyed my Onik Shabbos. This is what happened. I'm coming home from Shul. He davened Kivasikin. And I see a man who I know who's schlepping heavy benches. And I see his son is next to him, and he's letting his father, it's in the summer, schlepping heavy benches. The father's sweating, and the son's just walking next to him. I couldn't be so well what I'm seeing. So I went over to the son, and I said to the son, your father's schlepping the benches, and you're standing by. So the son very proudly said, I don't rely on the Eruv. I don't rely on the Eruv. I'm choshish for the sheet of the Rambam that you need to have a Tzuras HaPesach every Tanamis. And my father relies on the Eruv. So Rosh Shlomo Zalman said, you're not allowed to get angry. You're not allowed to get angry. But I was so upset. So I said to him, you think that you're a frum boy? Carrying from a Rishus HaYochid to a Carmelis is an Issa Drabanan. And the Erev is good, I use the Erev. Kibur Av is an Issa D'Oraisa. So you're not from, you're violating an Issa D'Oraisa to keep maybe a Drabbana. And I helped the father schlep. He still wouldn't schlep. I had to help the father schlep. I couldn't see. Azov Tazovim, I couldn't see that the father should be schlepping the benches. That's the kind of human being he was. His modesty was renowned. He left in his will that I don't want you to put any titles on my gravestone. The only thing that I think that you could write that's probably true is that he tried his best to teach Torah to as many Talmidim as possible, which is what's on his grave. That's what's on his gravestone. That was the life, at least some of the highlights of the life of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Have a good day.
You can be here for 2 minutes. I have to show you something.